naughty, bold, and sly. You nasty, but you dirty. Take it away. You're terrible. You're awful. Take it away. I thought I heard him say. I thought I heard your buddy bold and shout. Open up that window and let that bad air out. Open up that window and let that foul air out. Yes, I thought I heard buddy.
Hi, this is trumpeter and composer Dave Douglas, and this is the Greenleaf Music Podcast, A Noise from the Deep. The music for this episode was chosen by author Ted Gioia. That was Jelly Roll Morton playing I Thought I Heard Buddy Bolden Say. Ted's latest book is called Music, A Subversive History, published by Basic Books. Ted's written a succession of important music histories over the years, and this one seems to bring together many of the streams of his thought. Spanning centuries, it talks about how innovators subvert and ultimately transform the culture. Reading it made me curious to talk to him both about the ideas he puts forward in the book and for some specific musical examples. I caught up to him on Skype. Hope you enjoy the conversation. As always, write to me about this show at podcast@greenleafmusic.com, and please support the show and all the projects at Greenleaf Music by becoming a subscriber and a supporter at greenleafmusic.com. Through our Bandcamp store, you'll be able to access the entire catalog, including lots of exclusive content, music, sheet music, all these podcasts. Come join us and enjoy this conversation with Ted Gioia. Ted Gioia, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me on as a guest.
I really loved reading your book, and I at first thought, you know, I'll just have Ted come on and I'm ask him to read the first few paragraphs of the book. But then I thought, you know, I'll just paraphrase the thing that really grabbed me right at the outset, which is that you say, sort of categorically, music history is not boring. Music history is about transformation and transcendence. And I thought, since you sent me this really interesting list of musical tracks to sort of demonstrate areas of topics from your book, I thought I would ask you how this track from Jelly Roll Morton sort of speaks to that issue and the larger themes in your book.
Well, we've just heard Jelly Roll Morton play Buddy Bolden's theme song. And I really think this exemplifies many of the key points in my book in a very striking way. Buddy Bolden, for those who don't know, was by all accounts the first jazz musician. Unfortunately, we have no recordings of him. You know, he made this music around the year 1900. Mm-hmm. And there were no jazz recordings for almost 20 years. And so we have this version that Jelly Roll Morton recorded of Bolden's theme song, which gives us some idea of what Bolden sounded like or his impact. Now, as you know, one of the points I make in my book is that there's this tremendous push to make music respectable. We want to make it respectable and dignified. And Dave, you and I both know as jazz people that this is important. We want to have respect for our art form and what we do. And we believe it's just as serious as classical musicians or any other genre. But we always need to be careful that in the process of respectability, we don't distort what the music's all about. So I think it's very fascinating to go back to this first jazz song by Buddy Bolden and understand what it was really all about. And here's what we know about this song. First of all, when Jelly Roll Morton sings it there, he has to clean up the words because the original words he knows he thought were too dirty to share with people on a record. Mm-hmm. In fact, the first time this song is mentioned in print in a newspaper article in 1933, the journalist says that he cannot put in print the real words to the Buddy Bolden theme song. So that's the first thing we know. The other thing Jerry Roll Morton told us is that Bolden played in very rough places in New Orleans. Now, for Morton to say this, this is amazing, because Morton grew up playing in the red light district. But he thought Bolden played in such difficult and rough places that, according to Morton, it was not unusual on a Saturday night for 8 to 10 people to be murdered at the venue where Bolden played. Now, this seems almost unbelievable. And we look at this, and that can't possibly be true. Wow. What else do we know about this song? Well, we know that Sidney Bechet says that you could get arrested in New Orleans for singing Buddy Bolden's theme song. And when he heard it once, Bolden played it. The police showed up and actually started beating people up because they were listening to Bolden's theme song. The other thing we know is that its original name was Funky Butt. And nobody uses that name anymore. But this tells you a lot about the origins of jazz. In other words, jazz originated with a song that was so dangerous you could get arrested if you sang it, that it was so dirty that the lyrics had to be censored. And if you went to hear it, you could go to a place where people got murdered. So now fast forward to the current day where jazz is taught in universities. And we have jazz at Lincoln Center, and you can get grants for doing jazz. It's important not to forget the origins of the music, and we have to understand that jazz comes from a dangerous, rebellious, radical place. Now, one of the things, the last point I want to make here is in my book, what I show is almost every musical innovation is like this.
Right, right.
You get back to the origins, it's always a very different story than what you were told in the music history book. So one thing I tried to do in my book, Music, A Subversive History, is to tell the real unvarnished story. And we shouldn't be ashamed of it. You know, we shouldn't be ashamed of it. This testifies to the music's power. And when we deny this, in many ways, we falsify the most important elements of the music that you and I cherish.
Well, I would say even in your book, you go further to say that's the reality of the development of all music, that it all comes from this place.
Well, absolutely. And if you go back in terms of music history, it always seems that music originates with outsiders, rebels, slaves, bohemians. You know, one of the first things that we learn when we study music are the musical modes. These are like the building blocks of music, and they all have names. There's like the Lydian mode, the Phrygian mode. But what no one ever told me was that the Lydians and the Phrygians were the slaves in ancient Greece. And they're the ones that came up with these, and these were always considered the most dangerous modes. These are the ones they always wanted to restrict and control and prevent people from using. And so it's a good reminder for us that these things become eventually established. They get into textbooks. No one thinks twice about the Lydian mode. It seems like a really nice, you know, sweet way of playing music. We shouldn't forget, because you're right, at every point in music history, innovation is always considered dangerous and disruptive. And that's one of the things that I think is written out of most of the music history books, and probably the real key thing people get out of mine is that, wow, the real story is very different from what we've been told.
You also, I mean, one of the great things about your book is that you apply across so many different eras and different time spans and different genres of music, this way of looking at it. And one of the things that you suggested we listen to is a bit of Glenn Gould playing Bach's Goldberg Variations. I thought maybe I would just play a little bit of that and then maybe ask you what brought you to feel like that would be a piece that would demonstrate some of these ideas.
That's excellent. Let's hear Glenn Gould.
Thank you.
So that's Glenn Gould playing Bach. You make an interesting point in the book, is that up until the time of Bach, almost all composers, I can't remember if you say that it's categorical, but that composers were basically singers or choir masters, and music came out of singing.
It's interesting to look at the backgrounds of all the great composers. And up until the time of Bach, almost all of them started out in choirs. They were singers. They wrote for vocal music primarily. And then you have this tremendous shift with Bach, where most composers study piano or violin. I mean, that's it's almost rare nowadays to find a composer that doesn't have some ability at the keyboard. And so Bach was a revolutionary, radical person in his time as part of this big switch. But also it's interesting to look that Bach's personal life is very different from what we might expect. And I do think this is relevant. Often we say, well, you can forget the personal life. But it's interesting to know, Bach is almost a poster boy for respectability in music. You can't be more respectable than Bach.
Well, he is now.
Well, they know, absolutely. But and I talk to people that know Bach's music really well, but they're surprised when I tell them that he spent a month in jail once. They didn't know about that, or they haven't heard about the time he got into a knife fight with another musician in the street, attacked him.
Wow.
They haven't heard about the time he was disciplined for cavorting with a young woman in the choir loft. They haven't heard about his amazing drinking exploits. I mean, amazing drinking exploits. On a 2-week business trip once, he built his church for beer, and it was enough to buy 8 gallons of it at retail prices. So, I mean, Bach constantly caused disciplinary problems for his bosses. And he was rude. He was unreliable. And it's exactly the opposite of what you're led to think about Bach as sort of this very staid, respectable person. And this is not irrelevant because his music was also radical. He had to defend himself once. He was called into the city council, had to defend why he was using all these unusual music devices. And he said, I have to use the most progressive musical approaches of my day. You can't restrict this. And there's very little musical criticism that survives from that, but the little that does shows that he was frequently attacked, and it was feared that he was putting too much of his own personality and his individualism, was too showy. It was a detriment to the church, et cetera, et cetera. So once again, the point I'm making is we consider Bach now this epitome of respectability, but it was disruptive. It was disruptive both in his musical life and his personal life. And in fact, one of the things I try to tell people, they often ask me, Dave, they tell me, Ted, is this new book about jazz? And I say, well, there's a little bit about jazz, but what you find is all these other musicians are like jazz musicians too. And you look at the real history of Bach, he's not that much different anymore from Miles Davis or Charlie Parker, and to be honest.
And that brings us to Glenn Gould, who, we think of as a quintessential performer of Bach and a lot of other music, but he also had some personality specialities, shall we say.
Well, that's right. And it's a good point, because Glenn Gould was often considered extremely eccentric. In fact, what was the conductor who said, he may be a nut, but that nut's a genius. and so people complained about Gould, but also they were very fascinated and attracted by his interpretations of Bach. And frankly, I'm not surprised, because Glenn Gould's eccentricity was a good reminder that this music is not so like set in stone, something like Mount Rushmore. It's got this quirky personality to it that Bach imparted through his own radical way. So in many ways, it's the perfect exponent of Bach to have someone as unusual as Glenn Gould to be the leading interpreter of the 20th century. To me, it's very fitting, and it reminds us of the real origins of this kind of music. Mm. The word Baroque was originally insult. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting how often musical terms originated as insults. Mm. But Baroque was originally applied to a music as sort of a derisive term. Many people think the same is true of jazz and these other terminologies, but it's revealing of how disruptive these styles are, that the word that originally was meant to be an insult turns into this respectable compliment or descriptor.
So when you say subversive history, you mean essentially that the music is disruptive and transformative in some way.
Well, that's right. And I think it's easy to forget nowadays because we're taught by the media that music is just entertainment. It's diversion. You know, in fact, Professor Steven Pinker came up with that famous statement. He said, music is just auditory cheesecake.
Did he say that?
That's right. And he said that music has only one purpose, according to him, which is brain stimulation. It stimulates your brain. And he says it's no different than recreational drugs or having a six-pack of beer. Hmm. And to my mind, this completely misses the point. Because music does not take place in your brain. Music takes place in the world. And it's disruptive in the world. And Dave, this is not just in the past. Hardly a week goes by when I don't read about some musician somewhere in the world getting into trouble or stirring things up. You know, these Hong Kong protests that are going on, they're singing music. In fact, I heard about this person who wrote a protest song in Hong Kong that had to remain anonymous. Mm-hmm. Because it's so dangerous to have composed this song. Putin in Russia is constantly cracking down on musicians. He recently announced that he, Vladimir Putin, was going to take charge of hip-hop in Russia. I mean, it's a ludicrous notion, but it tells you how afraid they are. And my favorite example, and once again, this is just a few weeks ago. In Thailand, there was a hip-hop song that was released that was critical of the government. Mm. And it went viral. I mean, everybody heard this song. It became very popular. And the Thai government decided they had to release their own hip-hop song in response.
Mm, wow.
So the ministry put out their own hip-hop song, which, as you can imagine, everyone ridiculed.
What's the title of the government's hip-hop song?
I don't know the title of the song.
You name-check some great North Korean pop song titles in your book.
No, so this tells you how wrong Steven Pinker is. That music may be brain stimulation to him, but government officials, authorities, parents, ministers, they all understand
going back
how disruptive music is. The history books need to take that into account as well.
Well, speaking of musical cheesecake, and that was what he said? That was the term he used?
Auditory cheesecake.
Auditory cheesecake.
Is what he calls music.
A few hundred years later, you recommended this track from Bing Crosby, speaking of cheesecake. And
okay.
It's quite a beautiful track. I'll just play a little bit of this. It's him recording I Surrender Dear with Gus Arnheim in 1931.
Stay away, but it costs more than I can pay. Without you, I can't make my way. I surrender, dear. I may seem proud and I may act gay. That's just a pose. I'm not that way, 'cause deep down in my heart I say, I surrender, dear. Are those little mean things we were doing? Must have been part of the game. Lending a spice to the wooing. Ah, but I don't care who's to blame. When stars appear and shadows fall, then you'll hear My poor heart called to you, my love, my life, my all. I surrender, dear.
Musical subversive, Bing Crosby.
Well, you know, that track is remarkable from a number of perspectives. One is just how many risks he takes. I mean, this is the number of tempo changes, mm-hmm. mood changes. I mean, this is almost an experimental track, you'd think. Yet this was the popular music of the day. So it's very interesting to see that something that is so disruptive musically can enter into the mainstream. But the other thing that's worth noting here is that Bing Crosby is able to sing in a completely different way on this track because of new technology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you go back to the popular songs recorded in 1925, people are shouting. In fact, I've heard like these love songs. You have a man and a woman, they're screaming at each other. It's supposed to be a love song. It sounds like an argument. And that's just because the recording technology was so primitive back those days that if you wanted to sing a song, especially with a jazz band, mm-hmm. you really had to project your voice very loudly to get over the sound of the band. But in the late 1920s, all these new microphone technologies were developed. Mm. And Bing Crosby had the brilliant notion that he could now sing differently. Mm. He could sing in a very conversational way. He could even sing in a whispery way if he wanted. And this completely changed popular music in the United States. And if you compare recordings from 1925 to 1935, it's a whole world of difference. And it reminds us that not only are musicians radical and disruptive with their song styles, but they also understand mm-hmm. how to use technology. And it's amazing how many technologies out there in the 20th century were used by musicians, frequently jazz musicians, as part of their music tools almost immediately as soon as they were developed. This is one of the things that gives me confidence that the internet will eventually become something to advance music, not just destroy it.
Mm, interesting. Are there other vocalists who you'd identify from that same period who were using that technology in a similar way?
Well, it's fascinating if you look at it. Everyone understood that there was a new way of singing that technology would allow. Mm-hmm. And so you have Rudy Valli out there. He's trying to sing through a megaphone.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays you listen to it and it sounds really corny. But basically it was just Bing chose one technology, Rudy Valli chose another. And Bing was the one that chose the one that worked out. But you know, you listen to Rudy Valli singing to that megaphone, it sounds ridiculous. The other thing I'll point out is everybody's singing style changed. If you listen to how Louis Armstrong sang in the mid-1920s with how he sang in the early 1930s, mm-hmm. even Louis has completely changed his way of singing. You know, even Louis got a very strong voice and it can really project. But all of a sudden, you see him using these certain nuances, and asides that he wouldn't have done a few years before. So it's really interesting. I think Crosby gets the most credit for this, but a number of people understood that, hey, these new microphones allow us to do things we couldn't have done before.
Do you think that that technology had something to do with the emergence of singers like Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald and maybe later Mel Torme and even Sinatra?
Well, absolutely. All of them were great at using the microphone. It's no coincidence that right after these microphones were developed, a new style of singing emerged called torch songs, mm-hmm. torch singing, which was really about this melancholy, lovelorn way of expressing yourself in song. And so all these people understood that the technology gave them a new tool. You know, Frank Sinatra, I'll just share a story about Sinatra I find amusing. This came from somebody who was an engineer who had to record Sinatra on one of his last recordings. And Sinatra was going to show up at the studio in New York after dinner. The orchestra part had already been recorded. So Sinatra was going to show up at the studio and just record his vocal. Mm-hmm. And the engineer was saying how nervous he was because you know how difficult Sinatra can be. And so Sinatra shows up. He comes in with his mafia friends. You know, they go there. It's late at night. Sinatra puts on the headphones. And the engineer said, you know, I was trembling because all I have to do, he says, is adjust the volume just to make sure that Sinatra doesn't sing too loud and make sure it doesn't go into any sort of distortion. And so Sinatra starts singing. And the engineer has his hand poised on the volume level. Mm-hmm. And he said, I didn't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. Sinatra constantly manipulated the distance between his mouth and the microphone mm-hmm. as he adjusted his own singing volume.
Right.
And he says, because, you know, Sinatra was such a pro. He knew how to use the microphone. He said, I didn't have to do anything.
Well, and I think that's also, it's interesting because that's now a skill that musicians come up with. Like when you first get in the studio, you learn very quickly how to modulate your distance and your use of the microphone and get special effects. The next track that you suggested takes this idea a little further of, you know, production values actually changing the music itself. And so it's the Beatles' I Am the Walrus.
Sure. I seen to it. It turned out it was dust. Keep your knife upon that because you can't do it. Oh, I'm telling you again.
I am the Walrus.
You know, it's interesting that this recording came from a period when the Beatles had stopped giving concerts.
Yeah, yeah.
And this was a radical notion that you could be a musician and not perform. Now, curiously enough, the other musician at that same era who also gave a performance was Glenn Gould, who we've already listened to. And in an earlier day, this would have been impossible. The idea that you could have a music career and not perform for audiences would have been unthinkable. But once again, it's the technology made this possible. In the case of the Beatles, it almost made it inevitable because they began recording songs like this one. Would have been very difficult to perform live in concert.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they start, you know, use multi-tracking and various kinds of devices. Sometimes they're overdubbing their own voices. They're bringing in all sorts of ingredients there.
Stereo panning and moving the instruments around.
Yeah, no, I mean, you could not replicate this same experience live in performance. And to me, this is revealing because once again, many of us feel, I know I feel this sometimes, that these new technologies we're dealing with nowadays are doing more harm than good.
Mm.
We've seen how the internet has collapsed the economics.
But Ted, you're such a brilliant and prolific user of Twitter. How can you say that?
Well, no, but this is, and it's like we're doing this podcast now. You and I have learned to adapt. We adapt to the technologies because that's what you do. And eventually, if you're like the Beatles or Glenn Gould or whatever, you find the technologies allow you to do things that you couldn't do otherwise. You know, one of the things in the last chapter of my book, I try to predict the future of music, which is impossible, of course, to do. But what I do say is that there are going to be new disruptions out there. And when people really probe me and they say, well, what are these new disruptions going to be? And I say, well, I can't tell you with any certainty, but I have a hunch. The next wave of disruption will use the technological tools that are now hurting musicians and will turn them around to empower the musician. Because that's if you look at even like hip hop.
I would say that's already happening.
Well, you know, you're right. It is already happening in various ways and in small ways and potentially large ones. But it's got to happen. And the great thing about musicians is they're creative. And they're not just creative about playing their instrument.
I think
they tend to be creative about other things as well. So these new technological tools will be transformed, and they'll be transformed by the musicians.
Absolutely, absolutely. And to bring this back to the Beatles, one of the points you make is that them changing not only the sound, but the whole concept of their music every few months forced the industry to change in the same way. Is that what you... Am I paraphrasing that properly for you?
No, that's correct. And I think it's an important point. You know, people often ask me what kind of music I like, what kind of music I dislike.
Mm.
Or do I, you know, sometimes they think I'm too highbrow. Sometimes they think I'm too lowbrow. What I say is the enemy and the issue is not the difference between highbrow and lowbrow. It's between creativity and the formula. And nothing stifles creativity more in the music world than the formula. Mm. And unfortunately, that's what the record labels are always looking for, even though they'll tell you otherwise, or we want something fresh and different. Mm. The major labels are always looking for the formula and trying to imitate it. And the great thing the Beatles did was they created an environment for the only time in music history that for five straight years, there was no dominant formula in popular music. If you tried to imitate what the Beatles were doing in 1964, by the time you got to 1965, it was very different. And same thing with 66, 67. The classic example of this is the band The Monkees,
mm-hmm.
who had a TV show which was supposed to imitate the sound of the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time the very first episode of The Monkees showed up on TV, the Beatles were already off in a different place. I mean, they were off at I Am the Walrus, and the Monkees are imitating the sound the Beatles had 18 months earlier. And this is amazing. And it led to a brief period in which record labels let go of control, and they almost let anything go. So you could be Frank Zappa or Jimi Hendrix or Janis Joplin or Bob Dylan or whatever, and you've got this enormous freedom because for that brief period, the music industry had no formula to follow, and it's glorious. And I wish it would happen again. I don't think it will, but we should be grateful because it led to an amazing period of musical creativity.
But I would argue that now musicians are just forced to work in their own environments and create that freedom for themselves.
That's absolutely right. As you know, I listen to a lot of new music. I listen to more than 1,000 new albums every year. I devote 2 to 3 hours every day to listening to new music. And the one thing I've seen is most of the best music nowadays is coming from small indie labels, or it's self-produced by the musician, and it usually violates the very rules that the major labels would impose on these players. And that's sad, but also it's from a certain point of view, it's good news, because today, more than ever before, it is possible for a person to launch their own record label and get their music out around the world. I mean, you could set up a record label in New Zealand tomorrow, and within 24 hours, conceivably have listeners all over the world. Now, it's hard to overcome the inertia of the internet, but at least the fact that it's theoretically possible is probably one of the most exciting things out there from my perspective.
I'm still going to keep mine in New York, but I have to say, Ted, like one of the persistent themes that I saw in your book speaks to this a little bit, and that is sort of the choice, the dialectic, the dichotomy between ecstasy and conflict. So it sounds like what you're saying is this complacency versus this sort of restless moving on and innovating.
And that's absolutely right. And it actually becomes most clear, I think, in a strange way, in religious music. Because religious rituals always involve ecstasy. You go all over the world and find communities where they have these powerful rituals. It always involves music. And you go back to the shaman would always have a drum, or people would use various kinds of performances to create a trance or an altered mind state or an ecstatic experience. But the interesting thing is, once a religion gets to a certain size, it becomes what we call organized religion. The people running it start to fear these same songs and musical devices. Because people start getting into a trance state, it soon becomes disorganized religion. And I think you see a tension there. It's a tension between, do we let people use music to get on this path to ecstasy? Or do we want to use this music to create conformity? And, you know, take, for example, the drum. The drum's a perfect example of this. The drum is always used in these ecstatic rituals, and it's clear that if you listen to drumming for 5 to 10 minutes, it actually alters your brainwaves. We know this now. It puts you in a trance state, and in a very individualistic, expressive state of mind. On the same token, though, drums are used in the military to instill discipline. In fact, the historian Huizinga said the turning point in which the age of feudalism and knights ended was when they began bringing drums into the army. All of a sudden, the individualism disappeared from the culture. So this is revealing. It's the same instrument, and depending on how you use it, it can be a pathway to individual expression, trance, ecstasy, and an altered mind state, or it can impose order and discipline. And the tension between those two approaches recurs throughout the history of music. And if people don't understand that tension, they can't understand why these musical innovations happened in the way they did.
You phrased it slightly differently in a different spot of the book. You said soothing lifestyle accessory versus subversive forced change, which I like that a lot.
Well, absolutely. You know, there's a tremendous push to turn music into a lifestyle product.
Right.
and to sell it the same way you would Nike sneakers or a slick new smartphone. And I don't deny the power of that, but that power of corporatization runs directly counter to how many people use music in their life as a pathway to self-expression and, and to their own personality, not an imposed personality constructed by corporation. And and once again, this is a tension that, that it's not going to go away in our lifetimes. Every one of us, whether we're a musician or whether we are just a fan, we have to figure out what our priorities are and how we navigate it.
I think that it brings a good context to this track from Sun House that you recommended, Death Letter Blues. Can I play a little bit of that?
Yeah, let's hear it.
He said, honey, gal, your love is dead. I got a letter this morning. How do you ring it red? You know, sir, hurry, hurry. I call a gal, your love is dead. Oh, I grabbed up my suitcase, took her down the road. When I got there, she's laying on a cooling board. I grabbed up my suitcase and I said I took her down the road. I said, but when I got there, she was laying on a cooling board. Well, I walked up right close, looked down in her face. The good old gal gonna be here to judgment day. I walked up right close. I said, I looked down in her face. I said, the good old girl gonna lay in her judgment day. The back of the 10,000 people standing round the burying ground. I didn't know I loved her till I let her down. Looked like 10,000 was standing round the burying ground.
Well, there you go, Sun House.
Well, yeah, and that's an amazing performance from so many different perspectives. But it once again, it tells you how disruptive these new musical styles are when they first emerge. You know, Sun House is one of the first blues musicians we know about. I mean, he was the mentor to Robert Johnson, so that's how far back he goes historically. Now, he continued to record into the 1960s, but still, this gives you a sense of where blues comes from. And you can't get much more disruptive than this. You could not write down on musical notation exactly what Sun House is doing in terms of the way he's distorting the tones, just the way he's bending the notes there. And honestly, in terms of music theory, I don't think he's thinking in terms of 1, 4, and 5 chords there. I mean, it's just, he's creating sounds. He's not playing notes.
And stories, narrative.
Yeah, no, and just the words. I mean, how disruptive is this? This is a song about getting the death letter. Now, the death letter back in those days, you'd get a letter in your mailbox and it would have a black border around it. So even before you opened it up, you knew this was going to be bad news. And he opens up the black letter, and it's that woman he loves is dead. So he's thinking about a dead body. You know, and you don't have this in modern music. You go back in the old days, like St. James Infirmary, my baby's laid out there cold and dead. Mm-hmm. But people don't sing songs nowadays about corpses and expect to get on the radio. But I mean, so you can't get more disruptive than this. You can't get more disruptive than this. The music theory, it's hard even to figure out. You can call it a dominant chord there, but it's more like a sound he's getting. The lyrics are completely beyond anything you'd have in popular music nowadays. The way he's bending and distorting the tones is completely, you can't even write it down. Now, what I find interesting, fast forward 50 years and people are coming out with little guidebooks on, this is a method book on how to play the blues. And they have little musical examples they'll write out. And I look at that, how could they possibly codify this music? Yet they have.
Well, right, and the rough edges get taken off, and in music school we learn how to play a 12-bar blues, but when you go back to Robert Johnson, most of them have irregular numbers of bars and phrase lengths.
Absolutely. You know, honestly, Dave, when I was coming up, I looked down on the blues. When I was in my 20s, I thought, well, this is simple stuff. I mean, and if to make it interesting, I had to take those 12 bars and come in with all these alternative changes. And then I started listening to the really old blues, people like Son House and Charlie Patton and Blind Lemon Jefferson. It was a revelation to me. I said, I thought I understood this music. I got no idea what these guys are doing. I know what they're doing. It seems like a magical ritual. It's not a 12. They're not playing a 12-bar blues. And so this is the, once again, as I say, the big thing in music is all musical styles become legitimized. And the legitimization itself is an act of distortion. So it's always important to go back to the origins and to try to experience it like it really was, because it's powerful. I mean, that Son House recording is amazingly powerful. And to me, that's one of the things that excites me about music, is to find these things.
Right. And the way that you talk about this being a subversive music is in your last chapter that you call This Is Not a Manifesto. And I was thinking of these, and I love them, and thanks for laying them out like that. It's more like truisms, and you have 40 of them. And I just want to read the 32nd one, which says, even love songs are political songs, because new ways of singing about love tend to threaten the status quo.
And I think absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's a notion that everybody knows about political songs, but they tend to think that they're very rare. They don't happen very often. And I'll hear people say, where did all the political songs go? You know, back in the 1960s, we had Joan Baez and Bob Dylan. But those songs aren't so common anymore. And my point is, no. The politicization of songs runs much deeper than we realized. And sometimes the most disruptive songs of all are these love songs. You know, when the Beatles showed up on Ed Sullivan's show, parents were afraid. Community leaders were afraid. Ministers were afraid. But every song they sang that night on TV was a love song. When they tried to stop showing Elvis Presley from the waist down, he was singing a love song. And if you go back into the medieval period, I mean, I could give many examples, but for 1,000 years, the church tried to censor all love songs. You know, not a single love song in the vernacular language has survived from the first 1,000 years of Christianity. And it's not because they didn't exist. We know they existed because the church councils frequently attacked them. They kept on saying, we got to stop these people from singing these dirty love songs.
But also, wouldn't you say that the earliest composers whose names we know were also writing non-religious love songs, troubadour style or otherwise, you know, of the flesh songs, shall we say?
Well, the oldest songs we know about are from these fertility rites in ancient Mesopotamia and elsewhere. And these songs are so explicit, you could not sing the lyrics on the radio today. That's how explicit these songs are. But it tells you how deep the roots are between music and sexuality. Today, someone recently did a study, and they showed that 92% of hit songs on the radio today reference sex. And they have 10.5 what they call reproductive phrases per song. And that's what they call the dirty parts of the song, or the reproductive phrases. And it tells you that even when we think things have changed, they really haven't. The same preoccupations that existed with songs 3,000, 4,000 years ago still exist today. And they often have to do with romantic and sexual relationships between people. And that, and to think that that's just a simple love song, it's not. Those songs are always disruptive, because when you have, the first thing you want when you have control over your love life is you certainly want to have autonomy and control over other aspects of your life. It's one more thing, and I think this is important. It's no coincidence that the earliest love songs we know that express personal emotion come from the same village in ancient Egypt where the first labor strikes occurred. Now, no one has ever called out the connection to this before I have, but if you look at it, it makes perfect sense. I sing about myself. and I sing about myself because I'm valuable. I'm important. My personal autonomy is important. And so singing about a love song and going on strike against the Pharaoh are not such different concepts as we might think. They're all connected.
Hmm. Interesting. So to bring this back to a sort of a jazz, maybe in the more modern era, I suggested a Miles Davis track. And I feel like when you're talking about explicit protest music, hearing something from a tribute to Jack Johnson might be something that you would have some interesting comments on. So this is Miles Davis, Right Off. So that's Right Off from Miles Davis, a tribute to Jack Johnson. And I wanted to play it both because, you know, the statement it makes about a boxer, Jack Johnson, but also that the music is, for its time, pretty revolutionary and influential on future generations of musicians.
Yeah, this is an important album from a lot of angles. I mean, one, just this whole notion that you could create an album after the effect, after the fact, through editing the tapes. Most people would have thought back then, and many people still think even now, that that's antithetical to the jazz experience.
Mm.
Editing tapes, that's not the spontaneity of jazz. But in fact, this album, my understanding is there were 4 months of recording.
Mm.
And then finally, just, you know, tiny snippets of it were taken out and became the album we now know as Jack Johnson. And this shows you once again that even technologies that people think are have nothing to do with jazz, like tape editing and splicing, which was originally considered the weak man's way out. You know, you made some mistake, you have to splice it out. Well, no, even these tools can be turned around and used as part of the process. And you got to give Miles credit for being very visionary here, because this was the era.
To be honest, also Tio Massaro, the producer.
Well, no, Tio, absolutely, because he's as important to the creative process here as Miles. But, you know, it's interesting, this whole era, and I still don't think people have understood this, is we had a period before that where recordings originated as songs. So you started with the sheet music, and then you turned that into a track. But then we've evolved to the point today where you don't start with the sheet music. You start with different kinds of sounds. Might be samples, might be a drum machine, might be whatever. And you mix and match those, and you don't need to have that song starting point. That's why people are so confused when they see that the Grammy for Best Song of the Year has 10 songwriters. If the song only has 3 chords, how do you need... How do you need 10 songwriters for 3? They don't understand is the way we conceptualize a song nowadays is very different. It's a recording from start to finish. One other point, though, I want to mention here. To me, this is important. And I think Miles Davis is a perfect example. During the course of the 20th century, musicians became anti-heroes. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, if you look at the Wikipedia definition of antihero. It's always somebody who's part of the establishment, but also works against the establishment. And they will mention in the Wikipedia article people like actors James Dean, Jack Nicholson, Marlon Brando, Paul Newman. They talk about writers like Ernest Hemingway or Raymond Chandler. But in this Wikipedia entry on antiheroes, it's fascinating. They don't mention music at all. Now, in fact, the first antiheroes came out of songs. You know, if you go back to English folk song, the most popular folk songs were about Robin Hood, who, if you recall, stole from the rich and gave to the poor. He was almost the originator of the antihero. But the point I want to make is in the 20th century, the musicians themselves became antiheroes, and we admired them because they had this defiant stance. So from this point of view, Robert Johnson is an antihero. Tupac Shakur is an antihero. Willie Nelson is an antihero. But maybe the greatest of them all is Miles Davis. And you shouldn't forget this aspect of Miles, particularly when he's up there like with Jack Johnson with his whole boxing posture on the cover. And it reminds you that, hey, music is powerful stuff and it's life-changing. And you don't even need to look at the song. Just look at the person making it, the album cover. And that shows you how powerful someone like Miles Davis is and cannot be minimized. People will say, well, that's extraneous to the music. But I say, no, these things are all integrated.
Yeah. To go back to your idea of subversion and protest within the music itself, explicit subversion, you mentioned Bob Dylan, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, and probably lots of other songs from him. But is there anything about that one in particular that you wanted to bring out?
Well, one of the things I tell people is music is a leading indicator of the future. You know, economists have this thing they call leading indicators. They'll look at housing starts or factory orders, and they say, by studying these indicators, we can tell you what the economy is going to be like 12, 18 months from now. And what my point is in the world of the broader culture, music is the leading indicator. Music, if you listen to the radio today, you can hear about social values in the future. So the blues musicians of the 20s anticipated many of the sexual values of the sexual revolution in the 1960s. But this recording of Dylan at the Gaslight, I think it's like 1961. You listen to this, and the whole, at the time this song was recorded, it's the Kennedy era, people are optimistic, the space race, we're going to the moon. But you can see Bob Dylan already understands the disruption that's coming in society. He sees what's going to happen with the protests, maybe not the details of it, but you listen to this, it's a Hard Rain's Going to Fall, and you've got to say, wow, this is like a glimpse into the future that Dylan's giving us.
That's really interesting. I think we'll out with that one. But I just want to say thank you so much for making the time. And it's a great, everybody should go grab it. Any plans for an audio version?
There is an audio book out there. I did not narrate it myself. I told them, get somebody with a cool voice. That's was my recommendation. So you'll hear it, but not from my mouth. But yeah, that's out there. And some translations are coming out soon, like in Chinese and Spanish. So yeah, this book should travel the world. That's my hope.
Well, it's really, really interesting. And thanks for sending a playlist and spending so much time talking about all this.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Dave. This was a lot of fun. Let's do it again sometime.
Absolutely. So we'll go out with Bob Dylan. Our Hard Rain's Gonna Fall live at the Gaslight. Thanks, Ted.
Thank you very much.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've slipped in the middle of 7 sad forests.
Hey, this is Dave. Thanks for listening to the Greenleaf Music Podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Send me an email. Talk to you soon. Thank you.
been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard rains are gonna fall. Oh, did you see my blue-eyed son? And what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around.